This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The Online Harms Act, also known as Bill C-63, it's the latest attempt by the Trudeau Liberals to try and deal with regulating the online world. Look, there's some good parts of this, parts that say they're going to deal with childhood online sexual exploitation. Nobody I know is in favor of that. There are portions to deal with revenge porn. Well, again, I don't know anybody in favor of revenge porn, but are there elements of the bill that go too far? Will they infringe on freedom of expression? Will they lead to people abusing this for political means? Those are very real concerns. Hello, welcome to the Full Comment Podcast. My name is Brian Lilly, your host. And this week, we're going to take a deep dive into Bill C-63, the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's been a lot of commentary that this is a bill that should actually be cut in two, the online harms portions dealing with children, revenge porn, etc., put into one. And then all the elements that deal with regulating speech, hate speech, etc., even advocating genocide should be a separate bill and get longer, deeper, more thoughtful study. Is that the way to go? What are the portions that we need to worry about? Or do we have some of them taken out of context? Ian Runkel is a lawyer in Edmonton, criminal defense lawyer. He also has a very large following online with his YouTube channel, Runkel at the Bailey, where he talks about legal issues, especially firearms, on a regular basis. We reached out to Ian to discuss this issue and figure out what he sees as problems from a criminal defense point of view. Ian Runkel, thanks for the time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let me ask you off the top about the online harms bill. It seems to be two bills in one, in my view. You've got a whole area that's aimed at stopping child sexual exploitation, revenge porn, things like that. And then you've got hate speech, incitement to genocide, all these other things. Does this seem like they've kind of jammed a bunch of things together that the only thing they have in common is that they might happen online?
This is really, I think, sort of an omnibus bill of all of the things that happen online that we don't like, sort of wedged into one big thing. But it also will have some offline applications as well in terms of things like the abilities to get peace bonds applied to people who they think might do something, which can include things like house arrest. So those provisions, it seems that they maybe should sever that off into a separate bill, but there's a lot of problems with this because the government really has this big idea that they can sort of tame the internet, and they're really bad at it.
I mean, tame the internet. I don't know what it's like in Edmonton, but you know, we've had a dinner between two G7 leaders shut down because of pro-Hamas terror groups taking over the event venue. We've had a political fundraiser for local liberal constituency associations shut down because the same pro-Hamas terror groups show up and take over the restaurant in a very affluent, nice part of town. I'm not sure that you can police the internet when you can't police the streets.
Well, a lot of the policing they plan to push onto social media organizations. And the problem is that in doing so, they're going to create tremendous costs for the social media organizations, both in terms of their internal moderation and processes, but also in terms of potential liability fines if they're within Canada, as well as the possibility of inspections. And so what we might actually see is some of these companies fleeing Canada in order to take up residence elsewhere to avoid these particular rules.
Okay, so let's get into that in a little bit. But let's go back to the first question that I asked you, and you kind of hinted at it in the first answer. Should this bill be split? Because on the question of sexual exploitation of children online, on the question of revenge porn, things like that, I don't hear a lot of pushback. I don't hear a lot of, oh, no. We need to have that. There seems to be unanimous consent, unanimous viewpoint that these are things that we should be looking after. And to me, it seems like if you had that as a separate bill, that would pass very quickly versus all the other stuff that we're, you and I are going to spend the next half hour or so unpacking. So should this bill be split?
It's certainly a good idea in terms of separating out, for instance, the Criminal Code and Human Rights Act stuff. The one thing I will say is anytime the government tells you we're here to protect the children, you should be very, very concerned, because that's usually a sort of wrapper for very bad legislation. And I think that a lot of these portions that may very well pass without too much criticism, simply because they say this is to protect children, are actually quite dangerous and quite charter infringing provisions.
So some of them may actually the child exploitation things. You're worried that there are charter violations within that.
Absolutely. For instance,
unpack that for me.
For instance, one of the things that is forbidden is any sort of visual representation that shows a child who's being subjected to cruel, inhuman, or degrading acts of physical violence, which would include, for instance, the movie Carrie. It's very difficult to craft these.
The movie Carrie, there's going to be an awful lot of people. I know the movie you're talking about. I watched it as a kid in the 70s. There's going to be an awful lot of who have no idea what we're talking about. This is an old movie.
It's an old movie.
What is it about Carrie that would trigger this?
It's about a high school student who is very badly bullied by her peers, and it becomes a horror movie because, you know, she's got magical powers, but it includes things like a scene quite famously where they trick her into a situation where they can dump pig's blood on her specifically for the purpose of degrading and humiliating her. There's a lot of like high school movies that include these kinds of scenes of bullying and would be about children because it's high school students.
Yeah.
And so you can say, like, it's really, we don't want to have videos of child abuse out there, but there may actually, and the other thing is that there may be good reason to actually show even those. Somebody who sees somebody abusing a child in public may videotape that and put it online in order to condemn that behavior and yet run afoul of this. So it becomes very difficult to say where the line is. And when they're sort of painting these broad strokes, they're going to get a lot of things wrong, and there's going to be a lot of situations where it may not be covered. Perhaps more contemporary, South Park. Oh my God, they killed Kenny.
Yes. South Park runs afoul of Bill C-63.
Potentially. I mean, there's exceptions there in terms of whether or not it has sufficient artistic merit, which, when South Park came out, was a hugely debated issue. I think that they've perhaps found some social traction, but what happens with all of this?
I can see the argument for and against South Park having artistic merit. There are times when it cracks me up and times where I cringe. And I think most of us are like that. And so, you could have that debate. You could have that argument. But depending on who's interpreting the law, you're essentially saying could result in, unforeseen instances of people being caught up in this.
Absolutely. And one of the things is that content that is actual, like, child sexual abuse material is already one of the most vilified and illegal sorts of things you can find online. Provider, like social media and so forth, as a major category, polices the heck out of this and watches for that kind of content on their media and actively reports it to police. One thing that I hope they'll fix, because it's very concerning in this bill, is that this could actually make it very difficult to prosecute people who are sharing some of that content online.
In what way?
There's a provision that if content is gets a notice. Essentially, somebody says this content is objectionable, which hopefully somebody who saw that material would say this content is objectionable. The provider is required to, within 24 hours, provide a notice to the person who posted that content. And what are they going to do when they see, hey, your content was removed, we've noticed this, is they may start destroying evidence. The police will often engage in lengthier sting operations where they're watching to see where this material goes, who's sharing it, and then you'll see those big busts where they arrest like 100 people.
Okay.
What we may instead see is one person who gets a notice.
That may go by the wayside because of these notices.
Somebody who gets one of these notices is very likely to just say, whoa, I need to expect a police visit, and then
burn the
that
hard drives
lost.
And get rid of everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully they'll put in some sort of exception of like, maybe we don't have to give people advance notice if they're sharing stuff that is that kind of harmful, because I'd much rather see those people face an actual, you know, arrest and prosecution. It's absolutely, we should be taking that material down, but prosecution's important. And if it can interfere with that, that's a problem.
You mentioned earlier that when people wrap themselves up in we're protecting the children, we should be worried. And it reminded me of, correct me if I've got the bill wrong, Ian, Bill C-51, I think it was, in the Harper era. And there were a whole bunch of measures in that to try and, you know, deal with different elements that they wanted dealt with. But I believe it was then Justice Minister Vic Taves, or Public Safety yeah. Minister Vic Taves, saying, you're either with the child pornographers or you're with us. And it was a horrible bill. There were horrible elements to it. But he tried to wrap himself up in, I'm defending children, why aren't you? It is kind of a thing that politicians will do. Politicians of all stripes. I'm not being partisan here. I'm picking on Vic Taves, as well as worried about what the current government will do. Is this something that you worry about when you see those statements, when you see these bills, that they're just trying to hide other things?
I mean, I'm sure that there is some motivation of, you know, we've got to protect the kids. The problem is that almost, it's one of those things that's a real red flag. Almost every time you see it, there's something in those bills that is really a problem. And this bill has a lot of issues that that may create real problems. Where the various efforts to regulate the internet that we're seeing, including ones that are supported by the Conservative Party right now, the sort of porn ID law, have a real possibility of sort of creating a balkanized internet where Canada okay. gets a lesser internet.
Hold on. Pierre Poilievre was asked, do you think that people should have to verify their age? That's vastly different than you've got to, you know, scan your driver's license when you're going on a porn site. There's a whole lot of grades in there, and that was used by the Liberal Party just before they bring out this law to attack him. I mean, there's politics on all sides on this.
Oh, for sure.
Which kind of drives me nuts. It's like, we're going to stop the child pornographers, but don't ask anybody their age if they're uploading or watching on Pornhub.
Well, the concern there is not just that it's don't ask anybody their age. It's got to be verified by some means. So it may actually be that you have to post your ID or have a picture taken of you for various, you know, there's technologies that purport to guess your age based on a picture. But that would also not just cover, it covers any site that has, you know, adult content on it, which isn't just Pornhub. It's also Twitter and Reddit. And at that point, if you're needing to have an ID for everything you do on places like Reddit and Twitter, then we've essentially created a digital ID, which is a real problem because that can very much suppress speech that might be legal but controversial. Mm-hmm. And that becomes that's my concern, is that it gets wrapped up as we need to protect children, but it instead is something that affects online discourse and speech, including legitimate lawful speech. So that's the concern. And there's plenty, I should note, All of the concerns that apply to that bill are wrapped up in C-63, in particular, because there's a section 65, and it just says it's under this category of duty to protect children. It says design features, an operator must integrate into a regulated service that it operates any design features respecting the protection of children, such as age-appropriate design, that are provided for by regulations. Those regulations won't come to a vote. They can just be, it's like the order in council to, you know, ban firearms and so forth. They can just be put forward with a stroke of a pen. And they could say, you must have this kind of age verification tomorrow. You know, assuming that this law was in place, they could just drop that down. And suddenly all of these companies have to adjust to that. They could do worse than that. They could do more content.
I'm glad that you're raising that, because an awful lot of people don't realize how much in legislation is left to regulation. And regulation is not passed by Parliament. It's not seen by Parliament for the most part. It is decided by bureaucrats after the fact. And what you just described is something that would leave an awful lot of the details up to someone who is not elected, who we have no recourse with, who has no accountability, and they're going to decide how the law is applied, correct?
Absolutely. And typically what we see is a sort of ever-expanding sphere of what they feel should be their influence. Bureaucrats very rarely say, I should have less power and I should have less things under me, because the more things that they deal with, the more money and budget and so forth, and the more important they get to be. And so we can imagine that this is going to grow, not shrink. So that's a very big concern to me. And I mean, I want to see a healthy Canada economically. And one of the things that I think Canada does well is our sort of ground game on social media and on this kind of content. But it will be very difficult for these companies to consider locating themselves in Canada if they may have to completely change their system at the stroke of a pen by a bureaucrat. Why would you want to subject yourself to that when it might be literally millions of dollars in order to adjust these things? And then you might have to do it again in 6 months.
You know, I've talked to people who are either in these major tech companies or represent them. And as you know, my industry, my company, they've had a lot of issues with big tech and the whole argument over how many, what percentage of ad dollars go to Google and Facebook versus everyone else. They're still major players and we're still partners with them. And they're part of the internet economy, as you say. And yet this government keeps coming up with bills that make it harder and harder for them to operate. And yet there are conversations about, should we leave? Should we withdraw certain services from Canada? Should we scale back in Canada? Which is really bothersome when you think about how much all of us rely on, whether it's storage services, email services, social media services, all of these things that are part of the economy that we wouldn't have thought of 15 or 20 years ago. They're there now. We're going to add these regulations on, and that might lead to some of them saying, you know what, we don't need Canada because they don't want us.
And it is a very real concern. And at those points, we end up with situations where these companies do flee, and then we can't regulate them at all. The other thing that we may see with some of these bills is if you prevent people from doing things legally, they may move things into, there may be a growth in illegal distribution channels, which have very few breaks. And so we may actually end up making our internet worse by driving out the people who are sort of the good actors and only creating ones that have no interest in following any laws whatsoever.
You're talking about the dark web.
Those sorts of things. Like if we chase out, you know, pornography is controversial, but we're not going to get it to go away. And so, for instance, if we drive out companies that try their best to make sure that things are not too toxic, what you'll instead see is a massive growth of people seeking out that content on other sources, which may not follow rules at all. And that's going to be a major concern I have with some of these bills as well. And when you look at just the legal exposure of operating in Canada, right now, I'm not sure what the global revenue is for Twitter right now. I'm just looking, is it in millions? I shouldn't be Googling right now, but it's 8%. The fines allowed for penalties are up to 8% of the operator's global revenue,
global
or 25
revenue.
Million. Yeah. Or 25 million, whichever is greater. So if you're talking about a company like Facebook or Google, Google's maximum fine for violating this is $1 billion.
Yeah.
If I'm Google, I'm starting
to say, you know what? I don't need to sell Brian his Google Drive account anymore. I don't need to sell the storage and all the other services that various people buy. I'm gonna decamp. I'm gonna leave.
And so we may actually see measures to just say, listen, I mean, as a market in terms of our money, Canada isn't the big player. We're basically the equivalent of the kid who goes to the grocery store once a week to buy a candy bar out of his allowance. And so when we say, listen, if you want to play in our sandbox, you have to follow all of these rules. They may say, we're just happy to block Canadians. And if we start getting blocked off of things like Netflix or, you know, Reddit or, you know, or Twitter, we end up with this world where as Canadians, we have a lot less access to the net. And that's becoming a very real possibility. Some of these bills, not C63 purports to give orders to take specific content online.
But you've also got C11, C18 and so on.
Yeah, and some of those include provisions to say that that websites have to be blocked if they don't comply. You know, if you don't have enough Canadian content and you're not willing to play ball, then we can block you from Canada. And that's a problem if you're looking at things like, you know, the BBC. We're never going to convince the BBC to put Canadian content on because that's not what they do. They're the British Broadcasting Corporation. All of these are very, you know, serious concerns. And to sort of tie that back to Bill C-63, when we start saying, listen, if you want to operate in Canada, we've got all of these rules and, you know, billion-dollar fines, it's easy to just say, you know what, we're going to decamp. Canada, you do what you want to do. We're just going to operate from,
Ian, we've got to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, I want to get into the rest of Bill C-63 because all of the issues around free speech, those are in the other part of the bill that we haven't talked about yet. And I want to get your take on the dangers, whether there's anything salvageable in that part of the bill, or do they need to go back to the drawing board? More when we come back. So we've talked about the issues surrounding things like the child exploitation, the revenge porn side of things on Bill C-63, but there's a whole other element. And this is the one that most critics are saying, huge impact on freedom of expression, freedom of speech. Ian, let me start here. I wrote a column when it first came out, my first read through. And of course, these are big bills and it takes a few days to digest and really understand, because what people don't understand when you get a piece of legislation like this is folks like you and I have to spend our time going back and forth between the existing law and what's there, because you'll get this section that says, and we replace this section with this. And you're like, well, what did it say before? And you got to go back and forth and it's dizzying at times. And so it takes a long time for us to break it out. But my first read on this was, this is not a serious bill for dealing with what are absolutely issues that folks want dealt with. But when you have a bill that says you're going to get, let me read this to you, potentially up to life in jail for either advocating genocide or, let me read this part, Everyone who commits an offense under this act or any other act of parliament, if the commission of the offense is motivated by hatred based on race, national or ethnic origin, language, color, religion, sex, age, mental or physical disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity or expression, is guilty of an indictable offense and liable to imprisonment for life. We don't put people in prison for life for murder.
Now, I think it's worth noting, well, nobody's actually going to get a life sentence for most of these things, right? It's a maximum penalty. It's not mm-hmm. going to be the average penalty, but it is going to be very interesting because this could cover some very minor offenses overall. One of the offenses that people commit that might trigger this is mischief. Somebody spray paints on, you know, a religious building, something hateful to that religion. Well, okay, that's a detestable crime, but it's spray paint, right, at the end of the day. And so it'll be like, okay, you're facing months in prison as a maximum
for the spray painting.
But life because of what you spray painted. And what that'll end up meaning is you might end up with a jury trial over a spray painting because you're going to have certain rights. But also, any other act of parliament could be really, really interesting. For instance, out on the East Coast, we're seeing disputes over fisheries. And so if they say, well, you decided to fish lobster out of season in order to, you know, because you dislike these other groups, then now you're facing a life sentence. It's like, what?
And for people that don't follow this issue, I follow it on the, you know, just gently, you're right. That could happen. Someone could say this is a hate crime.
Yeah. And I mean, the courts are usually reluctant to find something as a hate crime because a lot of the time when people say something is a hate crime, it's more somebody with mental illness. But, you know, there is this real possibility that you'll get people facing where the very serious charge is this enhancement. And the other thing that happens is you get people who get into a dispute and they get angry and they say something offensive specifically to upset the person that they're angry with. And it might be something that they wouldn't otherwise say. Maybe they've been punched a couple of times in the face before they get to saying something like that. But now they've gone from like, we're having a bar fight to I'm on the hook for like, there's a maximum of life. Even if they're not actually likely to get a life sentence.
And look, I'm not against tough sentences. I'm a tough sentence kind of guy. It just seems like compared to where this current government is on other issues, getting rid of a mandatory minimum for your third conviction of gun smuggling under C5, reducing sentences for all kinds of other crimes, and then they come up with this. And I think there's four instances where they've moved the maximum sentence up from 2 years to 5 years to show that they're really, really serious about this. To me, this side of the bill seems like it's performative, that it is for show rather than being a serious legal attempt to deal with real problems.
And I think that we're going to see a lot of situations where, I mean, nobody's actually going to get life. It's the maximum on this. The minimum is nothing. But it's a straight indictable offense, which means that they can't go by summary conviction. It cuts off certain options in terms of sentencing.
We've got summary convictions for terrorism offenses. You hide a terrorist, you can get a summary conviction, which means if it isn't spelled out in the legislation, it's a maximum of six months in court or in jail. Am I correct?
I'd have to check. I sadly don't have all of the sentencing memorized. I always check. But if it
isn't spelled out in legislation, a summary conviction, you're not going to jail for more than 6 months, right?
I think they upped it to 18.
You've got summary convictions for things related to terrorism, and you don't have summary convictions here. As you say, it could be spray paint.
And it's
detestable,
one of the things,
yes, but life?
This may actually discourage the laying of these charges and sort of if I'm a prosecutor, let's say you've got a guy who has spray painted his, you know, he spray painted a shed somewhere and he basically says, like, whatever. Now I'm considering whether I want to lay this charge. Well, if I lay this charge, now this person, because they're liable to imprisonment for life, has an entitlement to things like a jury trial. And do I really want to run that on a shed spray painting? I might say, well, no, I don't. I'm going to just leave that out. And so that also becomes a concern. The other thing...
And then people who are upset at the offense, and rightly so, say, well, why aren't you giving them the full charges?
And then it's like,
they lose faith in the justice system because they say, well, but you could be charging them with more and you're not. So you're not taking this seriously. And like, let's say it's a religious... place of worship, as you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
You know, if your church, your synagogue, your mosque is attacked, that is very personal, is very visceral for you. And you're going to want someone to face full consequences. But because this bill goes so far, you're saying there's a good chance prosecutors will just, let's leave that aside. And then you've got the public feeling like the prosecutors aren't taking it seriously.
And what they really ought to be doing on this, I think, is splitting it into, so, you know, there should be a summary conviction option for this, for those situations that are less serious. I can certainly see situations where it might be really, really serious. If you've got somebody, you know, they've got the swastika tattoo on their forehead, they go to a synagogue, they barricade the doors and they set it on fire while everyone is inside. I mean, first of all, they'd be looking at life imprisonment anyway, but I still think, you know, that's a situation where you're like, okay, that's where we want to take it up to a life imprisonment maximum. Mm-hmm. But we don't necessarily want to do this over somebody who, you know, at a bus stop throws an empty coffee cup. Like, is this really the same category? Do we need a life imprisonment, like, maximum? Does it have to be that indictable offense that triggers all of these protections? Or should maybe the Crown be able to say, we're going to proceed summarily in this case because while it might be, you know, might be more serious, but we still don't need to go that far. You know, life doesn't have to be on the table for this one.
I want to hear your thoughts on what some have, in my view, unfairly characterized as thought crimes. Look, I don't like the portions of the bill related to the peace bond for fear of committing a hate crime.
Yeah.
Not my favorite part of the bill, but... It's not, first off, the Harper government put this in, and maybe you would know if it's ever been challenged. The Harper government put this in one of their last bills in 2015 for fear of committing terrorism. And it's still on the books. So if it's been challenged, it hasn't been successfully challenged. But there is a requirement that if you're going to try and have someone get a peace bond for fear that they will commit a hate crime, you've got to get the attorney general involved. That's a pretty high bar.
Yeah.
Then you've got to take it to a judge and present the evidence. That's a pretty high bar. There are at least checks and balances on that, that there aren't in other provisions of this bill, like the Section 13 that we can get into in a moment. I still don't like it, but do you think that sort of thing would face a challenge or would successfully survive a challenge? Has this sort of thing been challenged before, this fear of a crime? I mean, that just leaves me feeling uneasy that you're going to get something for fear of a crime.
The thing is that they have to actually bring evidence to say that fear is reasonable and is supported. So they can't simply, I don't think that they'd be able to get this on the basis of you have posted online and you dislike a particular group. It would have to be something a little more serious than that, because if they start using it to just police speech, then they're going to run into serious charter issues. But we do actually have a number of these provisions that allow for instance, a peace bond. If it looks like you're going to get into a fight with somebody, you may never have done so, but they do sometimes impose peace bonds, for instance, when like two neighbors can't get along and they keep getting into situations. But they do need evidence for that. And I don't think we're going to see this used a lot. I think I suspect we'll see this used actually in situations where people have already committed some sort of hate propaganda offense or hate crime, but it might be difficult for them to lay out the full proof, or where the circumstances might be such that...
Let me give you an example and tell me if I'm on the right track, wrong track. I'm some yahoo, some jerk who every weekend goes out to a church, a synagogue, a mosque, temple, what have you. And I'm always outside with the really nasty slogans. I'm screaming in everyone's face every weekend. Could they eventually just say, you know what? We think he's going to keep coming back. We need to do something. Is that where this provision would come in? Or is it for something else?
Now, the thing is they could probably already use provisions, like just the existing peace bond provisions, depending on what it is that you're saying.
Which seems like is a real issue with this bill, is that there's a lot of it where there's already provisions in the law.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that they could put like an electronic monitoring device on you, which that is concerning to me because those are actually incredibly expensive. And you pay for that if they impose it on you. Normally, you see those on like bail conditions where somebody's like, I will agree to pay for this because otherwise the alternative is that I will not be let out. I'm concerned that they may put these conditions on people and then like we've imposed it on you and you have to pay for it. That might be very concerning.
And so, so if you can't pay for it, you've got to stay in jail.
Well, they can't really jail you on this because it's a peace bond. It's just like, are people going to end up with these debts that can then be enforced? I'm not sure how that's going to end up working. But the standards for this, I think, are going to actually be fairly high. It has to be reasonable grounds for the fear. And usually where you, like the main use that you actually see of peace bonds is situations where somebody has already been charged with a criminal offense and it gets sort of pled down, even though a peace bond isn't really a plea. So you'll see situations where like two guys get into a bar fight and instead of saddling them with a criminal record, they'll say, how about you guys, you know, how about you just go on a peace bond and stay away from that dude? Maybe get some
you
treatment.
You can't both be at Billy's bar on Friday and you got to stay away from each other.
Exactly. So here you may see situations where somebody has already committed or likely committed a hate propaganda offense or a hate crime. And instead of going through that full prosecution, you may see them imposing this as a, you know, as a step down. Okay. And so it's like, rather than proceeding with charges, I think that'll be the main use that you see for this is somebody who's already committed it.
Ian, you are fairly robust in defending civil liberties. And you seem to be saying, could be some problems with this, but don't worry too much about this section.
This isn't the part that actually worries me the most.
So what does that?
It's largely the material about what they can take offline and what they can, one of the concerns I have is actually with the intimate images, the revenge porn aspect of things. And I think that is way too broad. It's very, and I mean, this is one of those things where everyone is like, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be sharing.
I don't know anyone in favor of revenge porn.
Except that you will actually, if you frame the question right, find everyone in favor of revenge porn.
Okay,
what do you think of the Sistine Chapel?
Beautiful piece of art.
Beautiful piece of art. And it's actually revenge porn, believe it or not, or at least portion of it. One of the Pope's sort of figures was criticizing the painting of it because he felt that there were too many nudes on it. And so Michelangelo, as a bit of a sort of a, you know, take this, amended one of the figures to put that guy's face on it and then depicted that person being bitten south of the equator by a snake. And that's permanently on there. It's a nude figure. And that was specifically done as a screw this guy. And it's one that now persists throughout history. But it's also a great work of art. Is this going to be something that we go, and we know that this person gave no consent to this. There's actually a lengthy history of using nudity in political commentary, depicting your political opponents as nude, typically in unflattering ways. We've seen this with Trump, for instance. There's lots of people who have depicted Trump sort of in the nude and sort of de-emphasize certain body parts. Well, Trump has not given his consent to that. But it also is very broad. It is if it is reasonable to suspect that the person had a reasonable expectation of privacy and the person does not consent to the recording being communicated. Well, reasonable to suspect is a very, very low standard. And it doesn't mean that there's no sort of proof required. And so, for example, if there is any artificially created image that depicts somebody in the nude, how do you know, as if you're the provider, how do you know who this person is? There's no requirement to track this person down. And so if somebody creates an image of nobody who actually exists, it's just an image of something that looks like a person, but is not actually duplicating a person.
And with AI right now, and the images coming out.
Yep. Then they would have to take that down, notwithstanding the fact that there is no actual person who looks like that, because the organization doesn't know. They would say it's reasonable to suspect that this is a person. And so we get into this real thing of policing content and all of this stuff. Basically, they have to respond within 24 hours when they get a notice. And so we may see a lot of situations where people are flagging content and it has to be taken down, because there's no way that they can determine that it's not actually, you know, intimate content communicated without consent. And so that may also apply to things that are not even pornographic, because if they have a 24-hour turnaround and they get something flagged, it may well be that the response is just to take something down. So, for instance, you have your podcast. Somebody flags it as containing, you know, whatever material. It might have to be taken down offline until somebody looks at it, and they may not want to go through. Like, if your podcast is an hour, they may say it's easier for us to just take it down and never repost it rather than go through it.
For me, as a content creator, your first 24 hours up online, your first 48 hours up online, and you know this from your very popular YouTube channel, that's when you get most of your views. That's you get most of your clicks. And so if you get flagged, if you get essentially swatted, then and it's taken down, you're not getting that back.
That's especially, you know, the graph is basically it goes straight up and then plateaus in terms of views. You get almost everything within that first 24, 48 hours.
And if you have a really good 24 to 48 hours, you can keep going. But if you don't, it's just flat the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If you got hit in that time. And especially you could also consider, what if you happen to get the big scoop? You've got the story no one else has. You know, you get a picture of a politician like breaking into his ex-wife's house, you know, something stunning like that.
Yeah.
You post it online. The political party that this targets might have an incentive to make a false report. It gets knocked down for 24 hours. Everyone's talking about it, but you're not getting the traffic of everyone wanting to come and see your pictures. And by the time you get it back online, those pictures are probably now everywhere. And so they've managed to effectively punish you for getting this report by preventing you from successfully monetizing it.
And if you can't make money in this game, then, well, you're out of business. So,
well, you just keep doing that to, if there's a particular news organization that is critical of a particular party, you just keep sniping them every time they try to make money, and pretty soon they go out of business. The abuse potentials for this become very high.
Huge. Let me ask you about Section 13 coming back. I was part of the campaign from about 05, 06 until 2011, I think it was withdrawn, to get rid of Section 13. And for this to come back, it seems like the language is trying to be a bit more nuanced. It's trying to have some parameters around it in ways that it didn't before. But I'm still concerned about the Human Rights Commission and the Human Rights Tribunal being able to fine someone $20,000 based on an anonymous complaint of someone who may or may not have been actually harmed by what was said or done. And then it becomes a money-making opportunity for people. Like we were saying, instead of taking away the monetization ability for a news organization, let's say, you're making it so that someone can make 20 grand a pop every time they complain that Ian Runkle, well, he said something I don't agree with. Ian Runkle said something that's against the Human Rights Code.
And I think we will, we've already seen Jessica Yaniv, for instance, filed a bunch of complaints and has not had a whole lot of success at the Human Rights Tribunal, but has filed complaints that have been found to be unfounded. And apparently for sort of purposes of, it looks to me like money making. And so if we see that kind of practice going on, you may have bad actors who are just like, all right, let's go like sniping these for profit. But you may also see a lot of reporting just as people saying, well, this is a way to tie someone up. I don't like what they're saying. I'll make a complaint. Now they're tied up in this Human Rights Tribunal stuff. It can become very difficult to be any sort of political commentator at that point if you're always getting tied up in it.
I think back to Mark Stein's famous case with this. One of the complaints about it was he, and this is very timely because we're hitting the month of Ramadan, and this joke only makes sense to you and is only funny if you actually understand Islam in Ramadan. And one of Mark's comments was, is it just me or does Ramadan come earlier every year? And of course it does, because it comes around every 11 and a half months. So yes, that's funny. But somebody said, no, that's an insult to Islam. No, it's not. It comes around earlier every year.
It's
that
a calendar joke. It's
yes. And and he was tied up with that for a very long time. And that becomes expensive. And then you start self-censoring.
We saw the case of the Quebecois comedian who made jokes about a disabled child singer who then ended up having to go to the Supreme Court as to whether or not that was a violation. I'm sure that was a ton of money on the line for that process. Every time somebody is controversial, and I know that there's people who are going to say, oh, this just affects, you know, the other people on the side of politics, so I don't care because it'll go after the people I don't like. It will, I guarantee you, be used against the side that you like as well. So if you are a right winger, you know, think about what happens if somebody is critical of, you know, any sort of sexuality, etc. If you're on the left, think about what happens when somebody posts something in favor of, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion sorts of things. All of these things could be targeted under these provisions and tie people up. And we may end up with a world where we just can't talk online without people sniping us into court.
Apparently the Human Rights Tribunal, by the way, is already fully backed up without these provisions. so all of this is going to cost us a lot more because we're going to have to hire a lot more people to police everything we're saying and doing and thinking. I don't deny that either on the child exploitation, the revenge porn side, or on the other side, that there are serious issues here. But do you get the sense that the government is trying to show that they take it very seriously by having very serious sentences, very serious fines, that they are using a sledgehammer to take on a fly when they could have done this in a much more nuanced way, dealt with the issues that are bothering people in a way that's charter compliant, that doesn't lead to the swatting, and that isn't just about performance?
I would love to see a much more nuanced, much more targeted bill. And there's no reason why they can't approach this incrementally. They can say, listen, let's go after the most, like the worst stuff that everyone agrees is bad. Because there are provisions in here that I think are good and provisions that I think are well-intentioned that can be later cut, you know, later fixed in ways that will make them good. But they just want to cover so much stuff that this ends up including everything from really, really bad content to hurt feelings. And it's the hurt feelings area that really can, you know, can cause huge problems. And it can end up, the courts may end up having to look at these provisions, and because they're so broad, it can be, listen, we have to throw out the baby with the bathwater because you haven't given us any other choice. I think we do need some additional provisions to deal with things like revenge porn and, you know, targeted deepfakes and these kinds of things. But they have to be done carefully, and they have to be done with nuance. And I think this bill needed a lot more study than it got before it was brought forward again. So I have real concerns.
All right. Ian Runkle, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let us know what you think. Are you concerned about portions of this? Has the government hit the right spot? Do they need to have a bit more study? Do they need to change this bill a little bit? Let us know what you think. Drop a comment, send us an email, reach out, and make sure, of course, that you're sharing this online. Full Comment is a Post-Media podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue, with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libman is the executive producer. You can listen to, watch Full Comment on YouTube, on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. We are there and available. Listen through the app or Alexa-enabled devices. And of course, you can help us out by leaving us a review, giving us a rating. And of course, tell your friends about us, share it on social media where you can. Until next time, thanks for listening. I'm Brian Lilly.